But today we are, as I say, working to a slightly different format. You will have found on your seats a copy of the book called When Britain Burned the White House, the 1814 Invasion of Washington, which is written by Peter Snow, our speaker today. We thought that it's a good subject to raise at this particular moment. Somebody came in and said that they always like to be reminded that the British did burn the White House, but unfortunately made the mistake of burning the Library of Congress at the same time. But that maybe Peter will want to say something about. But Peter has written this book. The copies on the chair are for you. He said if you'd like him to sign them afterwards, he's very happy to do so. He hardly needs any introduction, Peter. He's a highly respected journalist, an author and a broadcaster. He worked in ITN for a time, and then he joined the BBC, and he worked on Newsnight. He was often seen in various parts of the world covering conflicts, but certainly to politicians like myself, my great memory of him was on election night when he had the swingometer under his control and he leapt across from one part of the set to the other, explaining to us the vagaries of the British electorate's decision on those occasions. He has now, in 2004, he and his son presented the BAFTA-winning Battlefield Britain for BBC Two and worked on the follow-up series 20th Century Battlefields. He is an author of many books, but this is one particularly today which we've asked him to talk about. So I have great pleasure in asking Peter Snow to talk to us.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's lovely to see so many friendly faces. I think this is just about the last gathering that I will be talking to before I go to America for the publication of this book in Washington, New York, in about a month's time, and I should be taking a flak jacket with me. Although I think I'm right in saying, actually, I don't think Americans here. Hands up. Oh, good, excellent. I think Americans, actually, I don't think it's a secret over there that we burned the White House. I don't think they think of it anything as other than part of the fun of history, in a sense, so 200 years ago, quite a long time. And so I think it won't be too bad. I hope that I'll be eating, you know, lots of nice food with lots of nice Americans. Having said that, I've had the most extraordinary 2 years studying what is, I suppose, the nadir of British-American relations. It's been absolutely fascinating. And a huge eye-opener. I mean, I didn't realise how bad things could get between us. And when you think how good things are, on the whole, at the moment, it is an extraordinary contrast. And the contrast is more than that. It's here we have America deciding to declare war, oddly and rather foolishly, on the country. America, one of the smallest navies in the world, declaring war on a country with the largest navy in the world. The position's completely reversed, although they were not going to declare war on America. But the scale of power in those days was, of course, although we'd lost the War of Independence 30 years earlier, there was no way, I think, Americans would say that we were going to lose the War of 1812. I would argue that neither side really won the War of 1812, but on the whole, I think, because the Americans declared it and didn't win it, probably they sort of lost. Anyway, that's another matter. What I really want to talk about is this extraordinary episode in the war. The reason the war happened, the War of 1812, in which this episode took place, was because, rather arrogantly, the British were in control of the seas, a huge navy. They were fighting Napoleon in 1812. The Americans wanted to trade with France. Understandably, the Americans said, look, we're a neutral nation, we want to trade with France. But the British were stopping their ships and saying, we must have a look here and see what you're doing. They were also, the British, very naughtily, saying that American sailors, many American sailors on American ships which they stopped, were actually Brits, and so they should come and work. You'd be pressed into working on the Royal Navy and going up the masts and pulling out the sails on Royal Navy ships fighting the French. Well, that was intolerable. On the other hand, on the Americans declaring war because of this, because their ships were being intercepted on the high seas, the Americans declaring war and invading Canada, and being foolish enough to, as I say, declare war on the nation with the biggest navy in the world, it was all rather odd. And we were fighting Napoleon. We thought we were fighting for liberty. And here were these Yanks, you know, who were very much a symbol of liberty. Damn it, I mean, they were. No question about that. They were fighting us. And they seemed to be on the side of the French, which was sort of, in a sense, they sort of were. So it was a very odd situation. And come 1814, when Napoleon mercifully abdicated after being knocked out at Leipzig,
at the end of 1813. He resigned at the end of in April 1814. And, of course, Wellington had beaten him in the peninsula, but also the really key beat, the really key trouncing of Napoleon was what the Eastern Europeans did, not what we did, at Leipzig and so on. And so Napoleon resigned. Then we were able to concentrate on this rather awkward enemy we had the other side of the Atlantic. And so a lot of the guys who'd fought very successfully in the peninsula and other professional soldiers in the British regular army would tell they were going to go to America. And they scratched their heads and said, What? Oh, I saw, 1812, yes, all right, fair enough. So they went across, 4,500 of them went across. And here we get to the characters involved. The excitement of this book is not just this extraordinary piece of history, which is such a contrasting piece of history to life today between Britain and America, but the characters involved. You have on the British side, you have General Robert Ross, who was a wonderful Northern Irishman, very gallant, very honest, very true, very charismatic, a very impressive character. And beside him, George Cockburn, Rear Admiral George Cockburn. And it's an amazing man, a fiery, ruthless, tough so-and-so, a Scotsman who was out to give these Americans a good lesson if he could. And he was really the one who ran the campaign, although he wasn't an army commander, he was a naval commander. This was an army operation in Washington, and also in Baltimore, which I'll come to in a moment. And so these two chaps across the Atlantic. Cockburn had already made himself very unpopular in Chesapeake Bay by bashing away since 1813, burning American houses, impounding tobacco crop, and being thoroughly unpleasant to the Americans. Americans offered $500 for each of his ears. They were so furious about him. I mean, they were determined this chap was just simply unacceptable, a disgusting incendiary. Cockburn joined up with Ross, who took these troops across once they were freed from fighting in Spain in 1814. The two joined up at the bottom of Chesapeake Bay and anchored there, and by Jove, 50 ships or something like that. Never, the Americans hadn't seen anything like this since the War of Independence. Suddenly the Brits were here again. What the hell's going on? What are they going to do? Pandemonium in Washington. Panic. Now, on the American side, you have the Brits then, Robert Ross and George Cockburn, with in charge of the whole operation a task force commander, Vice Admiral, one rank above Cockburn and Ross, Vice Admiral Sir Alexander Cochrane, in charge of the whole operation. He was the sort of task force, he was the kind of field house figure. Then you had on the American side, a fascinating team as well. James Madison, the president. A cerebral, studious, rather introverted, wonderful, fascinating character, huge. I mean, father of the Constitution, he wrote the Bill of Rights. Tremendous guy, but not a war commander, not a war leader. He'd been more or less pressed into declaring war on Britain in 1812 by people saying this is simply unacceptable, what the Brits are doing, impounding our ships and so on. So Madison, he declared war. His war was a failure. Canada was not being invaded successfully. It was a complete shambles on the Canadian border. They very simply couldn't get any territory off the Canadians at all. They did manage to burn the Parliament in York, Toronto. I think actually that was American soldiers running amok. I don't think, to be fair, burning the Parliament in York was an act of state like what happened in Washington was. I think the Americans just ran amok in York. So anyway, they had burnt the Parliament in Toronto, which wasn't very clever, because it obviously gave the Brits an excuse for what they did in Washington. On the American side, then, you have James Madison, this fascinatingly sort of serious-minded, cerebral president, with his extraordinary wife, Dolly, D-O-L-L-E-Y, still thought of as one of the great American first ladies. She was outgoing, she was attractive, she was exotic, she dressed in turbans and wonderful sort of bright dresses. She went around at parties at the White House with a little silver snuff box offering people a pinch of snuff. And she served ice cream. They loved ice cream in the White House in those days. Well, still do, no doubt. But, I mean, she was a great ice cream person. And she was one of them, very outgoing, hated the British, like, of course, Madison by this time did, too. I mean, it's been pretty unpleasant, the war, over the last 2 years, 1814, August, when the Brits had turned up. And also, there was the army commander, the command of the army in America. Now, this was extraordinary. Here are the Americans who'd won the War of Independence, decisively against the Brits, bashed them up and sent them packing. It sent the biggest nation, the biggest, most powerful nation in the world packing already 30 years earlier. But come 1812 to 14, the Americans were in military were in complete shambles because the Republican Party in charge of America did not really believe in a regular army. And anywhere regulars of the world were up fighting the Canadians anyway. So what you had was a man called John Armstrong, a disastrous, stubborn, hopeless character who was in charge of defense. He was the war secretary. And, I mean, he didn't believe in having a regular army. He didn't believe in having people standing by, you know, being trained and so on to deal with foreigners arriving. It was chaos. There were militia who were supposed to be called up. Most of the states who were asked to produce militia said, no, sorry, we're far too busy looking after ourselves. We can't do anything to sort of save your federal capital. So forget all that. And so it was complete chaos. The commander in the field was a man called William Winder, Brigadier General William Winder. He was even worse than Armstrong. I mean, he was chaotic. He was frantically trying to get troops together. Not any idea what the Brits were up to, setting up in Chesapeake Bay. Where were they going? Were they going to Annapolis? Were they going to Baltimore? Were they going to Washington? I mean, goodness knows. Anyway, the Brits turned up. They had this shambles on the American military side, and this rather sort of head-scratching president, and this wonderfully exotic wife, Dolly. Just to give you the sort of main characters with this dramatis personae, as it were. Anyway, the Brits turn up, and George Cockburn, who was junior to the task force commander and was the naval commander of the naval force that turned up, but not in charge of the whole operation, he said, right, what we do is we go to the Patuxent River, a place called Benedict, land the chaps there, we march up to Washington and burn the place down. And the other people in charge, Cochrane and Ross, said, well, George, we hear what you say, but we'll see what happens. We'll certainly land and we'll start marching and we'll see what the Americans do. And the instructions from Whitehall were to give the Americans a bloody nose. It was a good drubbing. The actual words were, give the Americans a good drubbing. Wonderful expression. Why not? Because that's not what the Americans. The British government wanted Lord Liverpool and Castlereagh. They wanted the Americans to stop fighting this war, which we thought was rather stupid and a damn nuisance. So let's give the Americans a good drubbing. George Cockburn and Cochrane, get on with it. Think of something to do. Well, Cockburn said, let's go to Washington and burn the place down. So everybody else rather scratching their head. Ross sort of rather reluctantly following on, saying, all right, I've got the army in the mind. Let's think about that. And they moved up the Patuxent River, and it became more and more apparent to the Americans that Washington was the target, although, of course, the Patuxent was a clever river, because you could have been going to Baltimore, you could have been going to Annapolis, you could have been going to Washington. It wasn't going up the Potomac, it was the Patuxent, the one next door. You need to look at a map, I'm sorry. So up this river they went. And when they got to the top of it, the Americans produced a force, about 1,000 chaps under William Winder to face 4,500 Brits. And Winder got up out of bed and marched them out about 10 miles outside Washington. And he took one look at the approaching Brits and said, I think we'll go back to Washington. So they went back to Washington the same day. That night, he heard that the Brits were marching not actually to Washington City itself, but towards a place called Bladensburg, which is 5 miles northeast of Washington, on the eastern branch of the Potomac, sort of where you actually cross a rather narrow part of the river, and then you could turn down to Washington. And he said, oh, we better go to Bladensburg. We better march our chaps out. We better take the whole army to Bladensburg. A whole army consisting of about 6,000 men, most of them young recruits, young militia. And so he marched his men. The same night that he got back to Washington, he marched them out to Bladensburg. The guys were absolutely exhausted. Many of them were very patriotic. They were, in fact, most of them very patriotic, very enthusiastic. I mean, a chap called John Pendleton Kennedy is a good example, wonderful chap. He was very excited about it all. He was a hero in Baltimore. He'd marched out from Baltimore, all his militia friends. And he lost his boots on the way down. And he was wearing dancing pumps. Odd. And his friend said to him, well, what are you doing in dancing pumps? He said, oh, that's quite straightforward. We're going to win this battle with the Brits if they try and get hold of Washington, Annapolis, or Baltimore. And we're going to have, obviously, the president will call a ball at the White House, and I'll be at the ball, and I'm wearing my dancing pumps. I should have my boots, but I did second best. So they were good, a great chap. And they were hugely patriotic. They were furious with these damn Brits turning up again 30 years after the War of Independence. What the hell is going on? The answer was, of course, they declared war on us. So it's not surprising they were turning up and being difficult. So, anyway, they arrived at Bladensburg, the Brits, and there were the Americans. Madison turned up himself on the battlefield and said, chaps, are you sure we're very well deployed here? Because he saw that what they'd done is they'd deployed three lines, the Americans, 500 metres apart, the first two lines, and the third line was 1,000 metres behind that. So you know, we're using a thing called the musket, which I'm sure you all know about. If you ever fired a musket, you'd be lucky to hit anything at 70 yards. So here they were, 500 metres apart, 500 yards apart, not able to support each other in these three lines. Robert Ross, the military commander, who'd been persuaded by Coburn, by the way, on the march up, because Ross had been saying constantly, and Cochrane had sent a message too, saying, I think, chaps, you might come back to the ships now. Coburn said, don't be ridiculous, ignore the man's commands, Robert. We're not going to go back to the ships, we're going on to Washington. It was Coburn who kept driving Ross forward and telling him to ignore Cochrane's orders coming from the fleet back in Patuxent River. Cochrane saying, I think 50 miles is a long way from the ships, come on, come back. And they didn't go back because Coburn drove Ross forward. And in the end, to be fair to Ross, he was behind the whole project. And when they approached, when they got to Bladensburg, he was going to beat the Americans and then he was going to burn Washington. Well, they did beat the Americans. It was a ridiculous battle. There were some very brave American soldiers. There were some very fine units there. There was a wonderful chap called Joshua Barney and some American flotilla men who fought very brilliantly indeed. But they were beaten. I mean, it was absurd. One line after another was wrapped up and rolled up. And Winder, this terrible chap, hopeless chap, the brigadier who was in charge of the American army, he kept on saying, guys, I think don't fight, pull back, because we can't beat these Brits. And the Redcoats, of course, they'd fought their way through the peninsula. These chaps had beaten the French, who'd won the Battle of Austerlitz. The thing was absurd. They simply just tramped forward, these guys, in their line, the Redcoats. And the Americans had no idea what to do. It's understandable. Most of the American regulars, as I say, were up on the Canadian border. So anyway, the Americans ran, effectively, from Bladensburg. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say Bladensburg was one of the worst defeats in American history. Very small scale, compared to Vietnam. But nevertheless, it was an awkward moment in Canadian history. I mean, American history. American history. Canadians, I may say, sort of clapping on the sides and getting on with defending their own country very successfully. But they weren't there. The Canadians were not involved in this thing. This was a British operation. So they went down from Bladensburg, the Brits. The Americans abandoned Washington. They were beaten in the Battle of Bladensburg. It wasn't really a great fight, apart from this little moment at the end when Joshua Barney fought very valiantly. The Americans abandoned Washington. Dolly Madison said, we better get out of the White House. James said, Dolly, you better pull out. And she said, well, I've got the dinner on the table because I assume you were going to win this bloody battle. Dinner's all ready, 40 people, lovely damask tablecloth, silver candlesticks, Madeira wine on the sideboard. I've got dinner all ready for your successful cabinet coming home with the military commanders. And now you tell me I've got to leave the White House. He said, yes, you better get out. And so she said, well, I tell you what, let's take the picture of George Washington. A very fine picture by Gilbert Stuart off the wall of the dining room, which successfully, it took her some time. She took a risk waiting to get this picture off the wall. Got onto a cart, then she told the servants to clear off, and off she went across the Potomac. And James Madison also across the Potomac, abandoning the capital. This was only the second president of American history, actually, to be a fugitive in his own country. The other one was George Bush Jr., if you remember, when Al-Qaeda attacked the Pentagon and so on, and George thought it might be unwise to go back to the White House tonight. So he was pulled off to an air base, I think, somewhere in the Midwest. Anyway, so there was the White House. There was Congress. In rode Ross with his horse, just coming up to Congress. Suddenly, bang, and his horse was killed under him. Some clot had gone and fired at the British commander's horse from a nearby house. So Ross said, right, I want that house burned to the ground, people inside killed, and then I want Congress burned. And Coburn saying, well, good for you, Robert. Excellent. That's the stuff. That's what we need to do, these bloody Americans. And so the house was burned down, the chefs were killed. The house has been rebuilt, actually. Beautiful house, beautiful Georgian house in very near the White House. And they're very near Congress. And so they went then on to Congress, burnt Congress, burnt the Library of Congress. Never mind the books. I mean, come on, let's go for it. Just hit the Americans. Make it hurt. Damn it. Now, interesting that Michael should mention the Library of Congress. There were some Brits at the time that they did that, even on Ross's own staff, General Harry Smith, who said, this is barbaric, what we're doing. When he got home to England, the sort of Tony Benn figure in Parliament, Sam Whitbread, said even the Goths didn't do this at Rome. So there were people scratching their heads a bit about the burning of Congress, and certainly the burning of the Library of Congress. But anyway, they did it in Cochrane and Rossi. Cobell and Rossi were sort of to help with all the fuss and palaver and the moral thing we're game making. We've been told to give these people a good drubbing. Now for the White House, up the Pennsylvania Avenue. Incidentally, Washington, a village, only really finished in 1800. Hardly anything there, lots of lovely little shacks and these two fantastic buildings. I mean, jewels of the Renaissance. I mean, the Congress is a beautiful building, same, much the same building as it is today, a smaller. And the White House, one of the magnificent buildings as it is today. And they marched up to the White House, went in, completely, doors all flapping, nobody there. In they went, and lovely smell from the dining room. Lovely smell. And they went in, they sat down at the table, and they noshed it up. They ate it, they tucked in. And it was great. And Coburn raised his glass and said, I give you down with Madison and you know, peace for America. And they all sort of tucked in and had lovely time, drunk the president's wine. And then Ross and Coburn said, right, chairs on the table and burn it down. So they, after their meal, they, in good British fashion, they then put the chairs on the table and they burned the White House. Now, mercifully, it was a storm. The next day, the 24th of August, it was burnt. 25th of August, there was a huge storm, and it was the flames were doused, and the wall survived. So the building interior, all the partitions and curtains and God knows what, absolutely knocked out, but the exterior walls survived. Madison and his wife had a terrible time trying to get refuge that night, on the 24th and 25th, those two nights, and Americans were absolutely appalled at what had happened. I mean, wouldn't you be? I mean, the army originally was just scuttling before the Brits. The capital occupied and burnt. It was a humiliating moment for the Americans, watching many of them from Georgetown and Brookfield, just around down the road. They were watching this happen, seeing the flames of their own public buildings. They also burnt down the War Department, the Treasury, and the State Department, just for fun, just to add to the thing. They were very clear about burning public buildings and not private buildings. For example, the Patent Office, the very brave William Thornton, the Patent Office Director, came out and persuaded the Brits not to burn the Patent Office down on the ground that patents were private possessions. So that was it. They pulled out of Washington. The President went back 2 days later, and George Cameron said, right, what should we do next? And Ross said, well, I think go back to the ships. He was the army commander, after all. And Admiral Cochrane was saying, well done, chaps, back to the ships. In spite of your doubts about it, it has been a great success, and I must say I do admire what you've done and so on. Coburn said, what are you talking about? 30 miles northeast of here is Baltimore. Baltimore is a much more powerful, wealthy, serious, populated city than funny old Washington, although Washington obviously a symbol. Never, Baltimore is a serious target. All we've got to do is I've marched a couple of days up the road to Baltimore and wham, burn it down too and pinch a lot of money. Ross and Cochrane said, I think back to the ships, let's talk about it. And so they did. They went back to the ships and that gave the people of Baltimore a contrasting gang of people, by Jove, from those in Washington and the presidential suite, a chance to get the place sorted out. And here's the other big hero, General Sam Smith. Joshua Barney, I mentioned, fought very valiantly at Bladensburg. General Sam Smith was the military commander in Maryland at Baltimore. And he was quite clear that this was not going to happen in Baltimore. He was not going to let the British do in Baltimore what they'd done in Washington. And he put trenches out. He got about 20,000 militia together. They'd only had 6,000 in Washington. 20,000 militia on the heights of east of Baltimore. He made sure the fort at Fort McHenry, that's the entrance to the small inner harbour at Baltimore, a key fort, was well fortified, guns all ready to fire and so on. Great chap called George Armistead was the commander of Fort McHenry. These were serious, serious soldiers. They were all warriors. They'd, Smith had fought in the War of Independence. And along came the Brits. They had decided by this time to accept George Coburn's advice. 3 weeks later, that was the trouble, Baltimore had time to get ready. And they turned up and they landed and Cochrane took his ships up and started bombarding Fort McHenry. And Ross took his army up and started approaching from the east side. Well, Ross was killed. Ross was leading his men from the front and some American riflemen killed him. And that was a bit of a shock. And, Arthur Brooke took over, nothing like as charismatic a figure as Ross. But Coburn was there at Brooke's side saying, come on, let's go, keep going, keep going. Sad to lose Ross, but you're a good lad, Arthur. We'll get there. We'll make it. And so they marched on. And they got to the edge of Baltimore. They found themselves facing a huge army on the American side. Numbers, anyway, and maybe they weren't all mostly militia. And they found Fort McHenry was not being suppressed by the bombardment from Cochrane ships. They couldn't destroy Fort McHenry. They couldn't. It was a very clever fort. It was a Vauban-esque fort, built like a little pyramid, brilliantly. There were no vertical walls to knock down and make breaches. Terrific fort. Still there today. You can see exactly as it was. And the Americans hoisted a great big flag, a huge great flag over Fort McHenry. Damn near the size of this room. 40 feet by 30 feet, this great big banner was. A wonderful thing. And they hoisted above the fort. That gave great morale boost to the people of Baltimore and also to the soldiers in the fort. And, the fort survived the bombardment. The bombardment was horrific. There were flares, there were rockets, there were mortar bombs. Three or four Americans died, but the fort survived. And the Armistead's defense of it was very successful. The army were again beaten at the Battle of North Point. The American army were beaten at the battle. They retreated because they had huge reserves back at guarding the heights above Baltimore. And Cochrane, the task force commander, sent a message to Coburn and Brooke, saying, look, I think we can't really support you. I can't get into the inner harbor. I can't get past this fort. I think we should just call this thing off. It's up to you if you want to go ahead, but I really think you'd be unwise. Coburn said, come on, let's go. He said to Brooke, he said, look, we can do it. We can do a night attack. We can defeat Baltimore. We burn it down. We'll be in there tomorrow. Brooke said, I think we'll just take a second thought about that. And I just talk to my commanders and see what they say. Coburn knew that the game was up then. The commanders again scratched their heads and said, I think, Arthur, probably it might be unwise. We're completely outnumbered. We've done good things in Washington. Let's just go home. The British pulled out. And that morning, the following morning, after bombardment going on all night, suddenly came to an end a young American lawyer, Francis Scott Key, a poet and lawyer, was watching all this from a nearby American ship. And he thought, well, it'll all be over. The Union Jack will be up there tomorrow morning. I'm nice seeing that fine Stars and Stripes up there the night before, but I think Brits will be flying their flag in the morning. It'll all be over. Baltimore will go the way of Washington. But he looked, strained his eyes. By Jove, the Stars and Stripes were still there. So he took a bit of paper from his pocket and a pencil, and he started writing a nice poem. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed the twilight's last gleaming? They took it home to the pub, and the Americans and the chaps in Baltimore, they said, that's a nice poem. We set that to music. So they got out of a British drinking song called Anacreon in Heaven. They set this poem to this British drinking song, and they started singing this thing. My dear, do you know it took 115 years for it to become the American National Anthem? There's a magnificent, that we all know, the song backwards. It was not in 1931 that it became the American National Anthem. I'm not quite sure why. Columbia apparently was a great national anthem during the 19th century and so on and so forth. But it took a long time. But this extraordinarily evocative song. But we Brits inspired the American National Anthem. So, that's the story. This extraordinary episode was all over. They pulled out, they left Baltimore, they went off, and then they went and attacked New Orleans. It was a tragic story. There was the Battle of Plattsburgh, which the Americans won, the Battle of New Orleans they won. Disastrous British defeat at New Orleans. The war was very much tit for tat. One side won one thing, one side won the other. In many ways, the Americans did pretty well, as well as they did against this most powerful nation. Canada was a total failure. On December, Christmas Eve, 1814, they signed a peace of Ghent. Neither side gained anything from the other. But I think the most disgraceful thing about the Peace of Ghent, both sides recognised it was a futile war, why on earth were either side fighting it? And from then on, things only got better and better and better until we found ourselves fighting on the same side in 1917. But I think the most disgraceful thing about the Peace of Ghent in many ways was the way that Britain abandoned the Red Indians. The First Nations, the Indians, the indigenous people of America. They'd been on our side fighting the Americans, obviously terrified, the Indians, understandably, at the American expansion westwards, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, all coming up. And the Brits were very much on their side and very much committed in the negotiations at Ghent to secure Indian rights in any peace that followed, they completely abandoned that commitment. And the Peace of Ghent was signed, the Indian stuff was just shoved to one side. And so we deserted our allies. People like Tecumseh, a very fine Indian chief who fought very powerfully with us and the Canadians against the Americans. That was a disgraceful item. I don't know what you think about all that. But, I mean, that was something we abandoned. And so, of course, the West, Midwest, was wide open to American expansion and so on and so forth. But there it is. I think it's a fascinating story. It was the low point in American-British relations, clearly, and things have only got better since then. I think what happened... The Americans talk about it as the Second War of Independence, which seems to be nonsense. It was not about independence. There was no attempt by Britain to... There was never anybody having the slightest intention of reoccupying or trying to reoccupy America. It was trying to stop the Americans fighting this bonkers war. And... So it was a rather futile war, rather foolish war in many ways, and rather tragic. But it does. There are, in this story, I think, all sorts of fascinating bits and pieces, which I won't go into now because I've run out of time, but you'll find them in the book. I'll end. I'll stop. Thank you very much.